Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Cassidy Randall, author of 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. She writes about the environment, adventure, and the people who expand human potential. Her stories have appeared in Rolling Stone, National Geographic, The New York Times, and other major media. Welcome, Cassidy.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's get this started by you reading the back cover summary of your book.
Absolutely, I'd love to. Grace Holman dreamed of standing on top of Denali, the tallest peak in North America. A doctor and mountaineer in Alaska, Grace had come close to the top, only to be turned back by altitude sickness and a storm that took the lives of seven fellow climbers in one remorseless blow. Other expeditions denied her a place because of her gender, and when a letter arrived from a fellow climber who'd only been invited on expeditions if she would stay at base camp and cook for the men, Grace got a defiant idea. She would organize and lead the first ever all-female ascent of the frozen Alaskan peak. Everyone told the Denali damsels, as they called themselves, that it couldn't be done. Men had walked on the moon. Women still had not stood on the highest points on Earth. But these six women were unwilling to be limited by sexist and misogynist. They pushed past barriers in society at large, the climbing world, and their own bodies. And then, when disaster struck at the worst time on their expedition, the team's actions would decide not only their fate, but how the world would judge them and all women's ability to climb and survive the fiercest mountains.
Wow. This is a true account of the first all-women's team of mountain climbers ascending Denali, isn't it?
It is, and in my research, I discovered it wasn't just the first all-women's ascent of Denali. This was the first all-women's ascent of any of the world's big peaks. I mean, as that says, by then, we had sent men to the moon, and women still hadn't stood on top of these highest points on Earth, right? And this popular belief at the time held that women were incapable of withstanding high altitudes, savage elements, carrying heavy loads, right? They were too weak and emotionally unstable to handle those things.
So when did this happen?
This climb took place in 1970, in June of 1970.
So describe the mountain, its terrain, and the weather challenges.
Denali, as a lot of listeners are likely to know, is the tallest mountain on the North American continent. And it's not the tallest mountain on Earth, but it is one of the biggest. So it rises from this low plateau on the tundra, scrapes the sky at over 20,000 feet. But because it's situated so low on the tundra, it gains a full 6,000 feet more from its base in elevation than Everest gains, which forces climbers to be on the mountain for a long time to acclimate to that kind of altitude gain. And what that means is they're also exposed to these wild weather patterns that Denali sees for a longer period of time. So Denali, because it is the highest polar mountain and it's situated close to the coast, sees these just quicksilver-fast, bitingly cold storms that come out of nowhere. I mean, even today, weather is really hard to predict on the mountain. And so Denali is famous for year-round just freezing temperatures, really intense wind, and very thin air like Everest, even though it's not as tall as Everest because of where it sits so high on the globe.
Well, we know the risk of mountain climbing in general. But what's the risk in climbing Denali, especially the way you described it?
What I thought was so interesting about this account is essentially where I opened the book with Grace Holman on this expedition in 1967 that exposes her to what this mountain is capable of in terms of how intense it can be and what the stakes are for climbers. So on that 1967 expedition, she was the only woman, and she was the expedition doctor on an Alaskan expedition to reach the top of the mountain. Halfway up, this storm broke over the top, and her expedition knew that there were seven men from a team above who were on the summit, and those seven men were caught in that storm. Winds on the summit in that storm in 1967 were estimated at 300 miles an hour, which is not a typo. And all seven of those men died. And Grace knew that. So she knew that that was something that was possible. And that was something that she couldn't deny being called back to the mountain, even with that in her head that she knew that those were the stakes.
So even those who successfully reach the top still may not ever descend.
No, it's even today, far fewer people summit Denali than summit Everest. And since the mountain has been climbed and starting to be climbed in the early 1900s, more than 100 people have died on the mountain, and dozens of their bodies still remain on the slopes. So it's not an easy mountain. It might not be one of the most technical in the world, but nothing about Denali is easy.
Well, what drives people to do that?
That is such a good question, and I love that question. And it can be different for everybody who loves mountains. And while I'm not an alpinist myself, I am a backcountry skier. I've dabbled in some ski mountaineering. I've been on long wilderness expeditions. And I've talked to a lot of people about why they do this. And there is this sort of ultimate presence when you are on expeditions like this, when you are living so close to the elements, away from all of these obligations of daily life and these distractions of daily life. And all you have to do is get up, make the decision to move forward, how to move forward, go to bed at the end of the day and repeat, right? There's this simplicity to it. And there's also this ultimate presence that comes from being so close to the elements that are unpredictable in some senses, where all that you have to protect you is your own wit and your own experience. And coming out of that often is, I would say, the closest that we come to grace in a lot of ways.
My guest is Cassidy Randall, author of 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. So Cassidy, describe these women who formed the team.
This was another piece that drew me to this story, because all six of these women were really complicated. And I think that we are still in an era, even today, and particularly back then, where women were only allowed to play certain roles, right? They weren't allowed to be complex. And we all kind of know what those roles that have historically been assigned are. They're lone heroine, damsel in distress, princess, witch. You know, we're villainized for being likable, unlikable, or we're supposed to be likable. And what I love about all of these six women is there are no clear-cut saints and sinners, because they just are real people. And so Grace Homan, who led this climb, just to give you a snapshot of how magnificently determined Grace Homan was. So she was raised in Holland. She went to university for a medical degree in Berlin in 1942, in the heart of World War II. Because she wanted to be a surgeon at a time when, less than 4% of doctors were women, and that was just the best university. So by the time she's 19 years old, she's fallen in love with a fellow doctor at university, married him, has a child with him, and then she's widowed when he's shot in combat just 2 years later. When she finishes out her medical degree in 1945, single parenting and raising their second daughter, her mom hops on a bike from Holland, procures another bike for Grace, and the two women cycle this small family out of wartime Germany. I mean, that is just amazing. So, years later, Grace ends up in Alaska, and she has her own stakes for why she wants to do this beyond just for her getting to the top. She wants to be invited on these expeditions to the Himalaya, right? The biggest peaks in the world. And she ends up in this sort of heartbreaking story, losing the love of her life to an expedition that she was barred from. And so she carries this really weighty survivor's guilt up the mountain. And she is joined by her deputy leader on this expedition, was Arlene Bloom, who was this talented Berkeley climber and a chemist. And Arlene had been denied on expeditions because of her gender, with some of the most absolutely ridiculous excuses. One of my favorites being that the presence of a woman would be unpleasant high on the open ice, not only in excretory situations, but in the easy masculine companionship of the height. So she had kind of heard it all and was done with being told no. And then you had this woman, Margaret Young, so fascinating. She was sort of a misfit member of the wealthy Forbes family, but you would never know it. She was almost like a pack rat in the way she hoarded things in her house. She was a small plane pilot, became a mechanic to learn how to fix her own plane so she could fly herself into some of the most wild places in the world to climb. You had, it was an international expedition. And so there was Margaret Clark, was this New Zealander who was a mountaineer and a geologist. She had been barred from an expedition to Antarctica because there were no women's toilets on the plane from Christchurch. And so all of these women kind of came together for all of these very different reasons why they wanted to climb this mountain. And that, to me, makes for really interesting team dynamics and really fascinating sort of glimpse into why people do this.
So there are 66 women, and Grace was the oldest, right?
She was. She was in her 40s at the time of the climb, which even today, you know, I think that the outdoor industry and professional athletes really, we value youth, right? And so for her to have done that as a woman in her 40s is also remarkable.
And how old were the other women?
They ranged down to Arlene was the youngest in her early 20s. So we're seeing a 20-year age gap. Most of the other women were in their 30s.
Okay. And how did these women first meet and decide that they would climb Denali together?
It almost was like these serendipitous, fateful paths. So Grace and Arlene, and I don't want to give too much away, find themselves sort of coming together through this correspondence that was actually addressed to Grace Holman's late husband, who died in the Himalaya. And in grieving his death, as Grace is going through his correspondence, she finds this letter from Arlene Bloom, who had wanted to go on this Denali expedition. But her plans had fallen apart, and she had been writing to Vin Holman for information about the mountain. And Grace sees this letter and thinks, is this sort of the next step? Essentially, Grace is battling this guilt. Like, had I been on that expedition in the Himalaya where Ben died, would different decisions would have been made? Would he still be alive? Would there be different decisions made if there were women on expeditions? What if I led an all-women's expedition? So that was just the way that that came together to me was almost cosmic. And then Arlene knew a couple of these other female climbers in sort of the Bay Area. And then there were some other just wild connections to the two women who were from New Zealand and the other woman was from Australia. And at the time, you know, it was a pretty small climbing community. There weren't a lot of women who had sort of the freedom and the funds and were willing to occupy this kind of fringe movement of mountain climbing. And so, you know, in some senses, maybe it's not surprising that they all found each other ultimately.
So they all had experience?
They were all very experienced. I would say the woman with the least experience was named Dana Isherwood, and she had only started climbing about 4 years before this Denali ascent, but she was so strong. And that's what all the women on the climb consistently pointed to, how strong she was, which also led to some friction in the team members. You know, the stakes that Dana had, she almost wanted to just bag the peak. She was newly married. She wanted to get home to her husband, who was also a climber, and tell him about it, essentially. And so you see her starting to push harder and harder and harder, even as someone like Grace, who's been turned back on two expeditions because of suspected altitude sickness, Grace knows in her body that she needs more time on the mountain for her body to acclimate to this huge elevation gain. And so as Dana pushes and Grace tries to pull back, you start to see this tension developing that really pushes them into the climax of the book.
Well, it's interesting because there's a timetable. You have to get to the peak in order to get down within a timetable. And the longer you take, the more risk you take.
Yes, exactly. And most climbers at that point were on Denali for a month. And you think about the way that people were climbing mountains then. It's sort of wild to think about this. It was siege style, so really different than the light and fast alpinism that we see today. It was more that people were carrying these just enormous loads, load after load, ferrying gear from camp to camp to set up a series of stock camps across the entire mountain. So by the time people have gotten to Denali using that method, they've essentially climbed the equivalent of four Denalis and having to ferry all of their gear. And so the park at the time that really regulated climbing required people to have 30 days worth of food and have all of this backup gear for when your gear broke or when it blew apart or froze. So, I mean, there was definitely a timetable that was both necessary and just savage at the same time.
Well, if they're carrying that many different loads in order to, leapfrog their supplies and place them where they need them, that's a lot of equipment. How much did that weigh?
They were carrying 60-pound loads consistently. And some of these women, I mean, Margaret Clark is tiny. She's maybe 5'2", you know, 100 pounds carrying these 60-pound loads up the mountain. And the photos, the archival photos from this climb are just make that seem so painful. You look at these snowshoes that they had, these unwieldy 3-foot wooden beasts you know, on each leg that they were using, and these heavy frame packs, and, you know, all the gear was so heavy, so different from today. And it is, I think it's amazing that anybody could do that at that time, no matter what gender you were.
Well, let's hold it right there. We have to take a short break. Before the break, you were describing, Cassidy, this heavy load that these women were carrying. Can you talk about the women themselves? I mean, you had Grace, who was in her 40s, and you had the youngest, who was in her 20s, and some of them were diminutive women, and they're carrying 60, 70 pounds up the mountain.
Right, and these are also women. I mean, they had kind of heard it all in terms of insult leading up to this climb. You know, they'd been told that there was no way dames could make it up that bitch, referring to Denali. Women don't have what it takes. You know, there are no real women climbers. Either they aren't real women or they aren't good climbers. And one of my favorites, women should be able to climb McKinley more readily than men. After all, they have all that extra insulation. But these were women who essentially had already been used to navigating men's worlds, right? So Grace was a doctor. Arlene was a chemist. Margaret Clark was a geologist. You know, Margaret Young was a small plane pilot and a mechanic. And then we have these women who are just used to breaking boundaries, right? And so I think, in a sense, they definitely felt the pressure, and that's very clear in their correspondence. But this was another summit, another boundary to break, and they had just to get to the top of it. And I think there is, in talking to Arlene now, she says, you know, it's wild that, like, I didn't even know if it was possible. She had so internalized this narrative that women maybe were weaker or that it was impossible, right? There were so few role models to look to. I mean, imagine doing something that literally everybody thinks is impossible to the point that you don't even know if it's impossible. But then I think as I look through Grace's, you know, journals and the journals of some of the other women, or Margaret Clark from New Zealand, who had a very different sort of take on things outside of where the timing was in the United States. It was sort of the very infancy of second wave feminism in the United States. And I don't think most of the women thought that it was necessarily impossible. They knew they were strong. They knew that alone that they could probably do it. And so that's what I find remarkable, though, about these women is doing, kind of showing us that it's possible to do the things that everybody else thinks is impossible.
Well, you mentioned talking to one of them. How many of them were alive when you began your research?
Only Arlene Bloom, who still lives in Berkeley and still goes hiking and, you know, is leading treks as much as she possibly can in her late 70s. And Margaret Clark over in New Zealand is in her late 80s. She might be 90 now, actually. And I have to say, I'd like to be like Margaret Clark when I grew up. I mean, she just has been starting to lose her mobility, and it really gets her so mad. And she refuses to use a walker and instead has a hiking pole in every room. I just so admire her resilience.
Oh. These were remarkable women. They called themselves the Denali Damsels, right?
They did. Their sort of official name that they used on the stationery that they created for their application to the park to climb and to try and get sponsorships to support this climb was the International McKinley Women's Team. But, and this is sort of salient to news today, even though the mountain had been named McKinley since 1917, it had already, when it was named McKinley, been sort of inextricably entwined with the name Denali that it had held when people first started to climb it, just embossed on the American mind as the place of a grand and far wild that was part of the American mythos, right? And so even in the 1970s, after the name McKinley for several years, a lot of people still called it Denali. And in homage to that, the women carried a flag that they hoped to plant at the summit that was embroidered with the name Denali Damsels.
And they were all compatible at the outset, weren't they?
And their sort of correspondence really speaks to this group of women who also became friends over the course of planning this. They hadn't all met each other. There is no record, very little record, of their first meeting when Grace Holman came down to the Bay Area to meet the California climbers in the December before the climb. She was also going to swing up and lead a climb in Rainier. And there's not much from that except a line from Dana in one of her letters that says that she had a great experience. And you can see between Grace and Arlene between this friendship, developing this respect. And then over the course of a month on the mountain, you know, and you think about this, like a month where you are never alone. You are sharing tent with at least two other women. You are constantly doing the chores of everyday life on a mountain. You are climbing upwards into increasingly thin air. Your body is sort of reacting to that in usually negative ways. Like there is going to be a breakdown in social dynamics. But what is interesting about this is that the women already knew it, that they would be really scrutinized as the first women to attempt to do this, and had already had these accusations that catfights were going to break down their team. And then you have Arlene Bloom, who is this sort of lifelong peacekeeper, and realizes as she starts to see this friction developing between Dana and Grace that it's up to her to keep the peace. And in the end, she might not be able to keep it. And is that the most important thing? And you see these different stakes that they all are juggling, particularly this idea that because they were subject to increased scrutiny, if they didn't all summit and return alive, that if anything, one single thing had gone wrong, that would be what would be focused on rather than any kind of success. And you can see that a little later. I mean, 2 years after the climb, Arlene opened the newspaper to find the news that it was this first all-women's attempt at Denali, 2 years after they had done it, right? And she's like, who are these women? And it was this five-woman team of Japanese climbers who had summited, but then three of them had died in the storm on the way back down. And it took me actually digging through a whole bunch of archives to find out that all five had summited. And the three had died. There were two survivors. But this national news did not mention the two survivors or the fact that they'd summited, only that these three women had died in the attempt. And so they were not wrong that there was a lot of pressure for them all to succeed.
My guest is Cassidy Randall, author of 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. Well, I hear you about this Japanese team that summited and three of them died. But all six of these women came back, but not without a lot of...
Oh, we're giving away the book.
Okay. So tell me what happened when Margaret got sick. I think it was Margaret. How did that... she was coughing a lot and...
Oh, yes.
And Grace and Margaret had some friction.
Yes. So there... Well, did Grace and Margaret have friction at that point? Maybe a bit. Yeah. So, I mean, in thinking about what Margaret Clark was carrying up this mountain, she had been this just like prolific mountaineer, lived for being in high places. All she wanted to do was travel the world and see the world and climb. And 3 months before this Denali ascent, she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, which can, in a lot of cases, rob people who are afflicted with it of the ability to walk. And her doctor told her that she didn't have long before she'd be in a wheelchair. And so this is her opportunity, right, to go on a big expedition. Midway up the mountain, she starts coughing, has this horrific cough, and it's likely bronchitis. Grace diagnoses it. She's the team doctor, right? And as part of this, they all take a rest day. And that's when we start to see this sort of like simmering tension between Dana, who just wants to push and push to the top, and Grace, who wants to take her time so she can actually make it to the top, kind of boil over. And what is this really fascinating line in Grace's journal that just takes you back, reminds you of what her background is and what weight she's carrying up the mountain. She writes after this episode, this fight with Dana, I am a little leery of leadership where leadership isn't needed after Hitler. And it just hits you again that you're like, oh my God, this woman lived through World War II in Berlin.
Wow.
And now she's leading these women up a mountain.
What an incredible woman. But she got in trouble as well, didn't she?
Yes. So this I also find so fascinating. So Grace does begin suffering from altitude sickness, but she doesn't admit it to herself. And she never really admitted her previous two times that she was turned back on Denali, being part of an altitude sickness struggle. What's interesting about Grace is that she also actually had tuberculosis twice when she was in her 20s doing her early medical rounds. And that disease obviously ravages the lung. And so, of course, she needed more time to go up the mountain, but she never even admitted that to herself. And part of that is this sort of theme that outdoor and mountain culture has only in recent years just started to confront, that it is this overwhelmingly masculine pursuit in which these, you know, classically masculine traits like speed, strength, infallibility, just just ability to push yourself are valued. And things like vulnerability, taking your time, compassion, those things are things to be hidden. They're weaknesses, right? And so for Grace to admit that she couldn't go as fast, that she needed more time, that her body just couldn't keep up, was a weakness. And Grace had come up in this time where she had to sort of shove away any vulnerability. And she grew these outer defenses that other people would come to call caustic, basically, just to have a place in this world of mountaineering. And this whole buildup of where Grace is willing to admit to herself where her limits are and where she will not admit to herself where her limits are is what nearly kills the entire team.
Well, they came to depend on each other to survive, right?
Yeah. I mean, in a lot of senses, in these wilderness expeditions, you have to depend on your teammates. And I think that's really interesting too, that it's very clear in their early correspondence that they were so deliberate about who they were choosing for this team. Not that they had a lot of options, right? Grace and Arlene, as they were putting this team together, there weren't a ton of women who could do this at the time, but they were so clear about that. They knew that altitude and being sort of out in the elements like that for that long kind of slays you raw in a sense. Even as those of us who love it just love to do it so much, it also takes you down to your barest self. And so if you don't like somebody at the outset of an expedition, you're probably not going to like them at the end of it, right? So they were very clear on that. But even, I think, with that kind of deliberation, it's sort of impossible to know how the body, how the mind is going to react as you go higher and higher up to sort of the roofs of the earth.
So this mountain tested this team. How did their
absolutely did.
How did their relationships survive?
That I also think is something that made me think as I finished up this narrative. I think in a lot of our cultural narratives, we expect kind of a typical hero's journey, right? And part of that hero's journey when there are companions is that we expect all of the companions to come back as lifelong friends. I mean, you think about that with some of our greatest epics, right? Like Lord of the Rings, for example. That's so ingrained in how we want things to end. And that is not how this ended. There, after this climb, they were never all together again. And there was actually quite a lot of vitriol at the end of it. And that can be hard for us to take in, right? Because if we want things to end a certain way, we want a bow, a neat bow tied up on things. And we want, I think in some ways, not just the success, there has to be success on every single possible front. And it can be disturbing to us sometimes when things don't end the way we want them to end. So I think that's all I'll say about that. But I think it's just another illustration that these were real people, right? Like they're not characters in a fairy tale. They're real complicated people.
I know it's extraordinary. Men go through harrowing events in the military. And they, when they come out on the other side, they form these lifelong bonds. And same thing with sports. When they go through adversity together, they get stronger together. And what I'm hearing you say is that mountain is a different beast.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that 1967 expedition on which Grace started her time on Denali in the storm that killed seven men, those seven men were part of an all-men's expedition. Of course they were, because it was very rare for even one woman to be on an expedition at that time. But that whole team was just an example in social breakdown, and they were excoriated for it. The leader of that expedition, that 1967 expedition where seven of his men died, was just dragged through the coals for their social interactions. So it wasn't unique just to Grace's team by any means.
What do you hope readers will take away from this incredible story?
I love that this is one of very few, I mean, I could count on less than one hand, the number of adventure and exploration stories in mainstream literature, you know, a la Into Thin Air or The Wager, that feature women. And I love that this is one of those, and that this, I wrote this book to be less like a nonfiction sort of plotting tale. I wrote it more as fiction because, I mean, the way that this story plays out, it's just incredible. Like, you couldn't even write this as fiction. And so it's fast moving and it's a fun read. And even though we've done a lot of talking about gender on this episode, I mean, I just want people to think, like, we don't read books like Into Thin Air or The Wager because they're male-focused stories, right? We just read them because they're incredible adventure stories. And that's what this is.
Well, I couldn't put it down. So I appreciate you writing it. But that's all the time we have, unfortunately. Thank you, Cassidy.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Cassidy Randall, author of 30 Below, the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali. I'm Mike Green.